Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Reports. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com with another edition of Film, Literature, and the New World Order. And as you know, because you've been playing along, you know that this month we're going to be talking about an extremely interesting book called Foucault's Pendulum. It is by Umberto Eco. And the more perceptive members of the Corbett Report audience, once they started reading this book, probably started to suspect a plan. Namely, they probably saw referenced in, I believe, chapter 2 of this book, very early on, Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, and you start to put two and two together. Oh, I see. Last month, James got us to read Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, and this month, he's getting us to read Foucault's Pendulum. It's all coming together. But actually, I completely understand why you would suspect such a plan, but you would be completely wrong in such a supposition because I did not choose Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. Last month's guest, Nick Hayes of Hayes Reviews, chose Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, and I did not choose Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum. This month's guest chose Foucault's Pendulum, completely, totally independent of last month's episode. He didn't even know we were talking about New Atlantis when he chose this book. So the real question is, who is this month's guest? And the answer to that question is someone that I hope you are already familiar with, but if not, here's a chance to get acquainted with him. His name is Tom Oliver Reganauer. He is the impresario of Reganauer Press at reganauer.press, and you will remember him from our conversation last October on self-publishing. You will also know that he is the publisher of the German edition of Reportage, which hopefully you all have adorning your bookshelves or the bookshelves of the German speakers in your life. If not, please get the German edition of Reportage. It is at reganauer.press, but let's bring him on the program. Tom Oliver Reganauer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me.
It is good to talk to you again, especially to talk to you about a book like this. What an incredible and interesting book. And the craziest part about all of this is not only the weird synchronicity of the Bacon New Atlantis conspiracy esotericism that seems to be weaving its way into the Film, Literature, New World Order series, but also the fact that no one has ever recommended this book to me, which is baffling, actually, considering this of the Venn diagram overlap of all of the things that I'm interested in. This is just about the perfect complete circle. So thank you for bringing it to my attention. But I guess the first question I have for you is why? Why did you want me to read this book?
When you asked me to propose a book, the only thing that came to my mind that would like fit the bill, I think it's called, was that book, because it was literally life-changing for me. I read that like 31 years or so ago when I was a teenager, and it obviously changed my life, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of stuff in that book that raises questions, and I'm from the southern part of Germany, and maybe to put that in context, like when I was 5 years old, I discovered the Beatles record of my mom, and I wanted to be a musician. And then when I got to school, I found school always boring. I had best grades, and it was just like, I felt it's like a prison. But I was always interested in books. I had all these books about insects and the weather. There was a German series of books, so I loved books. And then I even, because I went to the bookshelf, I found that when I was 8 years old, my aunt recently gave me that. I wrote my first book when I was like eight. It's a little piece of paper and there's a date in it. So I wanted to do something with books or music all my life. And then I got to what we call Gymnasium. So I think it's like the school for teenagers. I don't know what the English...
high school.
Maybe it's high school then. And they, because I'm German and I went to German high school, they literally... killed any interest of books, because you have all this Nazi literature, the Third Reich, you have to be guilty, it and then you have all these old books with a very complicated language. So at 14 or 15, I didn't have any interest in books anymore. And then I broke my leg when I was skateboarding, and I sat at home and I found one book in my mom's bookshelf, which had a weird title. I didn't like the title, and that's exactly the reason why I read it. And then I had time, and I read all the other books. It was Hermann Hesse. So, and then I read all the other books she had from Hermann Hesse in a week or so, from Siddhartha to Demian and all these classics. And then once I could walk again, I went to the bookstore, and searched for something that is as cool as Hesse. There must be an author or something that is interesting. And then I went to the bookstore and looked around, and I came across the book, Foucault's Pendulum. And just because of the name of the author, because I thought Umberto Eco, being interested in music, Eco sounded kind of cool. So I just bought it because of the name of the author. And then I went back home and read the first page, and I basically threw it away because it's I mean, I'm not sure about the English version, but in German, it's a level of German language that I haven't seen before in any modern book. It's really complicated. And I think he mentioned that in one interview. He sorts out his readers by the first two pages. If you are not able to get through those two pages, you're out. But then at some point I managed to read the book. And I found it interesting as I went along. And obviously there is the Illuminati at some point. It's fiction. But he mixes fiction with facts, and the first thing you come across at some point are the Illuminati, and I have never heard the term. I didn't know anything about that, or the Knights Templar, or anything else that comes in the book. But then, when I finished the book, I went back to the bookstore, and then I asked the lady, and that's I think the important thing. I asked the lady if she knew the Illuminati or what that is. And they had an old CD or something. They were not connected to the internet. They had a CD with, I don't know, the catalog that they got on a monthly or quarterly basis. And she found that one book. And that one book is this one. It's literally called The Illuminati, from a guy that, Mr. Livid. And I read that in like another night. And the next day, the world had changed. Because, I mean, he does have a lot of this, like, Jews are bad and the financial system and blah, blah. But it covers the Federal Reserve, it covers the school system, the Rockefellers, the Balfour Declaration and all that stuff, the World Wars. And that literally, I mean, changed my life. I would have had a very different life, didn't I, by accident, stumble across Umberto Eco's book. And that's the basic reason why I wanted to propose it, because nobody else that I know, nobody else has ever read the book. So I'm not able to talk to anyone about the book. And you are the first person where I can do that. So I appreciate you raise
a good point there, actually, because I haven't thought about this yet. But yes, I will probably never be able to talk to another human being about this book ever again, because no one will ever read it. But here we are. We're actually two people who have read and appreciate this book. And, you know, your story is fascinating and interesting and funny, because as soon as you mentioned those books that you got when you got to high school and they're trying to make you read these stuffy books with this incredibly difficult language, I'm like, wait, do you like Foucault's Pendulum? Because yeah, it is not an easy read. But yes, it is a fascinating and provocative read. And as you say, it mixes reality with fiction in a way that is fascinating and provocative and philosophically interesting, because of course, as people who have done any sort of precursory research on Umberto Eco will know, he was a semiotics professor. He was a philosopher essentially at heart. And that comes through when you start to get into his work in a more serious way and some of his nonfiction and other things. I will throw, for example, a YouTube video I came across on The Ashes of Postmodernism, A New Realism, a conference with Umberto Eco, which is an actual lecture that he delivered at this one conference that shows his philosophical chops and some of the things that that he talks about with regards to this. But yes, you raise, of course, first of all, the first thing that most people will encounter when they pick up this book is that it is an incredibly difficult, incredibly dense, incredibly what can I say? Offensive tome, insofar as, yes, there is this sort of impenetrable barrier that you have to break through in order to get into the book. And once you do, I think it is quite rewarding. But as you say, Eco very specifically said in one of his interviews that I saw with regards to Name of the Rose, which I have not read yet, but I am going to now that you've introduced me to Eco. He said that the first 100 pages of that book, the publisher was very enthusiastic about the book, but said that first 100 pages is too dense. It's too historical. Get rid of that first 100 pages. Get into the story. And he said, no, I will not do that, because the first 100 pages is the penitence that you have to pay in order to enter the Benedictine monastery, exactly as an initiate into the monastery would have to pay penitence in order to gain entry. He said, if you're not willing to pay that first 100 pages penitence, then good, go on, be on your merry way. You do not deserve to be here. And I think there is probably some aspect of that in this work as well, right?
And he even released an addendum book to The Name of the Rose of 120 pages, because I think he left something out in the first 100 pages.
Yeah. Fascinating man. And there's so many things that we could and should discuss when it comes to this. Let's start with that mixing of reality and fantasy, which of course is kind of the core of what this book is about. And I will start with the observation that simply the epigraphs of these 120 chapters in and of themselves are something of an achievement, because some of these references are so obscure to, you know, 16th century Latin texts and things that, and I will, of course, confess, I certainly did not check the veracity of every single one of these 120 epigraphs. I didn't even check most of them, or even more than a handful of them. But the ones that I did check, yes, checked out. They were real, actual references with the correct page numbers. I mean, I did see an interview in which Echo said he spent 8 years doing the research for this book. And the only thing that surprises me about that is, only 8 years? Actually, that's quite impressive, because you could spend 40 or 50 years and probably still not acquire all of this, which speaks to Echo and his incredible reading. For people who are interested, you can see on YouTube, there's a video of him showing off his library at home, which is just his apartment is just wall-to-wall books absolutely everywhere. He had something like 50,000 books. And I think that shows in the writing of this. But it shows that there is a real grounding to what is being portrayed in here. It's not like this is just some, you know, spaghetti being thrown at the wall and whatever comes out. No, there is a lot of actual real historical detail with real facts that are being strung together in a way that certainly sounds plausible as it's being put together. Let's talk about that and how this narrative, this story starts to come together, or is in fact created by the characters.
Yeah, I mean, maybe up front, the language itself, I was interested in writing songs, because I did hip-hop at the time, and that book provided a huge resource for words I haven't even read or seen anywhere before. So that's another thing. And afterwards, I read each and every book of Umberto Eco, and I'm basically using the same approach for my articles nowadays. If you're not getting through the first two paragraphs, then screw you. It's gonna be complicated, because I'm not writing for people who are buying the penny newspapers at the bakery. So because that causes too much discussion. And the plot itself is interesting, because it starts in the Musée des Arts des Métiers in Paris, which I actually first time I think I saw the pendulum was like 3 years ago, and my wife and I went there for her birthday, and we visited the museum and the pendulum.
Happy birthday, honey!
Yes. She was more interested in the arty part of the museum. I was searching for that bloody pendulum, because the building is pretty huge. The building is pretty huge, and I didn't find it. It's hidden in some like corner. But it's interesting, because it starts off with that pendulum, which is an interesting metaphor or picture, because it kind of somewhere in the book he explains that the telluric currents or something are being used or are being measured by that pendulum, and then it kind of implies where at the center of the world is, because it kind of proves rotation, and then obviously once you have that pendulum you are at the center of the world, but you can hang the pendulum anywhere in the world, so it will always be the center of the world, which is an interesting story, and where it starts there and it ends. And I actually thought about sleeping in the museum at night when they close doors, because that's when the book opens with that secret meeting where the secret society meets. So, but it's very interesting as far as the real world connections, because still today I'm finding stuff that he references in the book that I'm discovering right now. And one of the things is, if I can also, I went to the bookshelf. So there is this Comte de Saint-Germain, that guy that pops up over hundreds of years in some writings at the French royal court or whatever in Germany. And then the guy released a book, which is that one, The Holy Trinosophy. I tried to start reading it, the Most Holy Trinosophia. I tried to start reading it, and it does have actual copies of what the guy wrote in handwriting plus an explanation. So the explanation is understandable, but the rest is really I have no idea what the guy is talking about. No idea. Absolutely no idea. And I think
it sounds like it should be published by Minutius Press, not Garamond.
Yeah, but the guy also wrote an opera or a piece of music, which still today is once a year played live in the Royal Symphonic Orchestra in London. And it's considered the most complicated piece of music that has ever been written. So, and then he was buried in Hanover, where there is a newspaper picture where he seems to be standing at his own funeral and stuff. So, I mean,
is he really dead?
Yes. And all that stuff in that book still keeps me busy researching today and thinking about it today. And that's the power of that book, I think, because Eco invested so much time in combining what he knew into something that is still an interesting story that starts in that museum with kind of a crime scene kind of setup, I would think, because it's about what's the guy's name? Belbo, then there is Diatolevi.
Kassobon
is the main character, because he then discovered that at some point that his friend and colleague was like hijacked from a secret, or suspects that he got hijacked by that secret society, and they start this like huge research activity in different books, and then they end up working at publishing house, I think Garamond or something, Garamond, where the three of them, or the two of them, I think Belbo and Kassobon, then use a computer and start, you know, collecting information. And then even there is a nice side story to it, where in that publishing house, he discovers that they have one like team that, or one part of the company that publishes serious books, and then there's the other part of the company that is a scam that charges authors a high fee for releasing crap, where they make the money to release the serious books, kind of. All these like sidekicks.
As a publisher, I'm sure you appreciate that. In fact, it makes me wonder if you had another alternative idea for recommending this book to me. See, James, this is the way. Not yet. But yes, okay, so let's get the plot synopsis out of the way, because I understand 99% of the people who listen to this conversation will probably never read this book. But essentially, the basic story is that, yes, this young scholar of the Knights Templar gets sort of roped into this publishing outfit that's looking for outside consultation on this manuscript about the Knights Templar that's presented to them by this Colonel Ardenti character who shows up with this. This is the part, you know, we're unlocking the secret. And if you publish this, it will bring people together and they can finally understand the plan and blah, blah, blah. And so they listen to this guy and, you know, they're asking Kassobon, the guy that they're consulting with, you know, is this guy a crank or whatever? And they kind of dismiss it. But then he goes mysteriously. He disappears, this Colonel Ardenti, after revealing this interesting text, which he's interpreted in a very elaborate way. And then from there, they start essentially with an interlude in Brazil. And I mean, there's so many different parts of the story, but eventually Kassobon starts working, as you say, with Belbo and Diotalevi at Garamond, and also with Minutius Press publishing these esoteric manuscripts. And they read so many of these, and these cranks who are coming up with these crazy, you know, tales of the Templars and the Freemasons and the Rosicrucians and everything else, that they eventually start constructing their own stories that start to connect and try to connect all of these different stories and all of these threads throughout history into this gigantic, elaborate plan that spans centuries and that brings all of these different esoteric threads together in this grand plan by which these diabolicals are questing after the navel of the earth, or whatever they're searching for, which will be revealed by the pendulum ultimately, which will show them the spot on the map and all of this. What they are really searching for is the power of the telluric currents, which will allow them to essentially control the earth and all of its natural power and all of this, blah, blah, blah. But it's all just some story that they're constructing sort of out of fun. But it starts to actually seem to manifest, and some of the characters that they're meeting seem to be actually part of this plan that they themselves are constructing. Anyway, that's sort of the bare bones detail of the story, and people who are interested by that, I wholeheartedly exhort you to give it a try. And I will say that for me, definitively, the point at which I realized this is going to be the type of story that I can actually, I think I'll definitely enjoy, came about 146, 147 pages in, where Ardenti is presenting them his manuscript, and they're talking about different parts of this elaborate plan that he's unveiling. He says, "Yes, indeed, such is the plan, the ordination, in its marvelous simplicity and coherence. And there's something else. If you take a map of Europe and Asia and trace the development of the plan, beginning with the castle in the north and moving from there to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Agartha, from Agartha to Chartres, from Chartres to the shores of the Mediterranean, and from there to Stonehenge, you will find that you have drawn a rune that looks more or less like this." There's an elaborate sketch that's presented in the text itself. And Bilbo asked, "And the same rune, ideally, would connect the main centers of Templar esotericism, Amiens, Troyes, Saint-Bernard's domain at the edge of the Forêt de Reims, Reims, Chartres, Rennes-le-Château, and Mont-Saint-Michel, a place of ancient druidic worship. The rune also recalls the constellation of the Virgin." "I dabble in astronomy," Diotalevi said shyly. "The Virgin has a different shape, and I believe it contains 11 stars." The colonel smiled indulgently. "Ah, oh, gentlemen, gentlemen, you know as well as I do that everything depends on how you draw the lines. You can make a wane or a bear, whatever you like, and it's hard to decide whether a given star is part of a given constellation or not." And that was the exact moment I'm like, yes, I love this, because I myself have very many times throughout my life reflected, like, does everyone else truly believe when you see one of those maps of the constellations and, like, clearly here's, you know, Perseus with his bow and whatever, and here's Medusa, and it's like, no, it's just a bunch of stars that you're just drawing these elaborate patterns over, but it doesn't actually look like that, right? Nobody else sees that, right? So that's the point at which I realized, yes, this is obviously an interesting book, and it's going to be about essentially how I would say that's one of the themes of the book. Yes, everything depends on how you draw the lines, right? And that is made manifest in a number of ways in this work. One of which, the obvious way, is that, of course, in contrast to this elaborate plan that Bilbo and Casaubon and Diotalevi are cooking up amongst themselves, that is contrasted with Casaubon's wife, Leah, who presents a very different interpretation of that strange text that Colonel Ardenti presents them with. A very, very banal interpretation that essentially this is a shopping list of sorts, that there's nothing at all esoteric or interesting about it. It's just a basic sort of laundry list from someone hundreds of years ago. And she presents and interprets that text in the exact opposite way to Ardenti, that everything is just a banal reference to something. And it makes about equal sense. Yes, she has to stretch and provide interpretation. What does the IT mean? Instead of itera, it's item, you know, and these sorts of narrative choices that she's making that makes sense within the text itself. Yes, you could make those assumptions. And in that case, this strange esoteric text just turns into a sort of banal laundry list. And I guess the text in some ways could be asking you, okay, so which is it, right? Is it this elaborate plan that's based on this centuries of Templar esotericism, or is it just a basic laundry list that you're just reading too much into? Or, as I think the real point of this text might be, it's sort of a question of what you want to do with these sorts of moments of interpretation. What is the point of the interpretation that you're trying to bring onto it? Because clearly Leah's interpretation is also an interpretation that also takes some leaps. And I guess you could argue that by Occam's razor, it's a more likely, you know, it's just a banal laundry list. It's not this esoteric plan of spanning centuries of esoteric history. But in a way, they're both speculations. So it's just a question of which speculation you prefer to choose. And that really gets down to the individual motivations. Why? Why are you pursuing this great plan or creating this great plan in your head? What is the point of it? And for the diabolicals, who are, you know, part of this plan, obviously it's to control the telluric currents and control the world and all of that. But why are Bilbo and Casaubon and Diotalevi involved in this? Why are they so interested in this plan and creating and crafting this and bringing it into reality? As Leah also observes, people will start to take you seriously. It's a nasty joke. You shouldn't do it. Which is why ultimately Casaubon sort of leaves Leah. So I guess to me, that is sort of the point of the book, is the kind of the why. Why are you doing this? Why are you trying to bring these dots together? Why are you drawing the lines where you do? And that's not a question that admits of an easy answer, I think. And it's something that people here in the conspiracy reality space, who really, we really are doing some version of this, should probably ask ourselves once in a while, why are we doing this? And what do we hope to get out of it? Any thoughts on that, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe to put a bit in to expand on the characters, which I think also relates to the author, Eco itself. So every character, like Casaubon, as you mentioned him, he was in Brazil and then met this woman, which is a communist, who turns out to be pretty materialistic in the end. But he also studied the Templars beforehand at university or something, and was part of the 68 uprising of the hippie movement in Italy, which I didn't even know happened in Italy. So you come across these characters, which I heard Eco in one interview say that he had a room where he really developed CVs for the characters before he even started writing the story, because he wanted to understand what kind of character that is. Does he stumble across that Templar piece and then is astonished by it? Has he worked on that before? Does he have a girlfriend, which is his political background? And then while reading the book, at that time when I first read it, I was like 16 or something, and I had this fuck the system attitude, but I didn't know what fuck the system meant, because I the only thing I knew, I'm not going to vote, they're all criminals pretty much, and I want to burn things down. That was like that was the youthful endeavor of fuck the system. But I didn't really understand what it means. And then I tried to understand people like Hesse, the first author, then or Eco, and I wanted to understand their take. And then he talks about, in a side note, about this communist lady that Casaubon meets and kind of despises that a bit. And then he talks about the 68 hippie movement, which he also despises. But even then, after reading the book and after reading all the other books that Eco released, I don't really have an idea what the guy itself thought. So, and that's a artful thing to do, because he's not upfront with I'm left, I'm right, I'm an anarchist or whatever that is. You have to find out on your own. There is a ton of knowledge. And all the stuff you mentioned in between, Rennes le Château or Mont Saint-Michel. I went to all these places, either with my parents before reading the book or again afterwards, to just check out what's going on there, because it's mentioned in the book. And just Rennes le Château is a small, uninteresting village somewhere in France, where there is nothing besides a church and a hill. But you start searching, because the Nazis went there, and you can go down that rabbit hole for weeks. The Nazis went there to search for the Holy Grail, and they had a huge expedition and whatnot. So there's all these nuggets, and the only question that is still open after 31 years, I have no idea what Eco really thought, because I think it's a very good thing that he leaves that open to the reader and for interpretation. That's why I think if the book wasn't that difficult to read, it would be one of the most amazing door openers for people who have no idea, because you are not telling them I know better.
No, it wouldn't. Because if it were easier to read, it would be the Da Vinci Code. And of course, in 2026, if you look up about Foucault's pendulum, you are going to see some version of, well, it's the thinking man's Da Vinci Code, which is an insult doubly, because first of all, of course, this was published like 15 years before the Da Vinci Code. So Dan Brown was clearly coming after Umberto Eco. But secondarily, it's also almost in a way implying that the Da Vinci Code is in some way above this, in some way, like, oh, the thinking man's, but you know, if you want the sort of bare bones, if you want the accessible version, read the Da Vinci Code. But no, in fact, Eco had the best response to this, because obviously he was asked about it a lot after the success of the Da Vinci Code, the remarkable, amazing international success of the Da Vinci Code, and people saying, you know, that was a lot like Foucault's pendulum, except a lot easier to read and more exciting. And so he was asked about it quite a lot, and he had some version of a stock answer that was something like, yes, I had to check into it after so many people asked me about it. And I discovered Dan Brown seems to, he was essentially one of my characters here in Foucault's pendulum. I invented him. I'm not even sure Dan Brown exists, and which I think is the best answer of this. But yeah, I think if it was more accessible, more blatant, more obvious, It wouldn't be what it is, because one point that he makes when he was being serious answering the Dan Brown question is that Dan Brown, in a way, is trying to, at the very least, produce believing in his audience. He said, I don't know what Dan Brown thinks. I don't know the man. Like, I don't know whether he really believes in any of this stuff. But at the very least, his text wants to make you believe in this. Foucault's Pendulum does not make you want to believe in this. It makes you want to at least think about what it is that you are believing and why you are believing and what does belief even mean when it comes to this type of plan, etc. It's a much more philosophically interesting thing. And yes, I think the fact that we don't know what position Echo held on this is actually the most intriguing part, because the way this gets dumbed down, I've looked at a number of reviews of this book. And of course, a lot of the easy take on this is that, oh, you know, now we live, although, you know, maybe in the 80s when he was writing this, it wasn't quite as apparent, but now it has become manifest with the internet. Now we live in this age of conspiracies online, and everyone's. And so this could be some form of an answer as to that stupid pop psych question we get. Why do people believe in conspiracy theories and blah, blah, blah? So I've heard a lot of people give that kind of take on this book, but I don't think so. I don't think Echo was that prosaic, was that easy to boil down. No, I think, yes, at the very least, maybe this is the steel man of that argument. It's not like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Oh, it's because it makes them feel better to think there's order in the universe or something. You know, that kind of pop psychology crap that we have all heard way too many times. Yeah. When people dismiss any actual evidence about 9/11 or anything else. But no, I think this is, in some ways, the steel man of the argument, in that it's about, as I say, I think it's about why we choose to draw the lines at all, anywhere. Why do we connect things in the way that we do? So let's boil it down. Let's confront the titular pendulum and what it does or does not represent and what it may or may not symbolize. In one interview that I saw, Echo said specifically, he started this novel from two images. And these two images were the Foucault pendulum, which I think he had seen, you know, earlier in his life, and a boy playing the trumpet in the cemetery, which was something that he intimated had been part of his experience in the past. So I don't know, you know, specifically what, but he had those two images, and the point of this book was to try to connect them somehow. So Foucault's pendulum in particular it's hilarious to me that I don't think Echo would have predicted this or thought about it at the time. But of course, Foucault's pendulum is one of the answers to the flat earthers, of course, because there is very simple and very accessible mathematics that prove not only the rotation of the pendulum itself, but also the length of time it takes for that rotation, depending on your latitude on the globe, is predictive of a round spinning object that we are all residing on. And I will get Brock to cut in the actual mathematics of it. As I say, it's fairly simple.
Let's put this into numbers. If it takes our pendulum 24 hours to travel the length of 2 pi e cosine theta, and if it takes our pendulum t number of hours to travel the length of 2 pi r back to point A, then the following relationship holds. Solve for t using r equals e cotangent theta. We get t equals 24 hours divided by sine theta. For example, in Paris, France, which has a latitude of 49 degrees north, it takes 32 hours for a pendulum to make a complete turn.
But having said that, I imagine most flat earthers wouldn't be able to complete such equations themselves, which is why there is still such pushing of that amongst the conspiracy sphere. But I would say that, of course, Foucault's pendulum disproves all of that, but I think that the diabolicals would make this part of their plan to spread flat earth, because it would throw people off of the Foucault pendulum, which of course reveals the center of the navel of the earth, which will allow people to control the telluric currents. They don't want people to even know about that. So Foucault pendulum can't even exist because the earth is flat, so don't even look at it. So clearly Foucault's pendulum was invented by Templars.
And I recently saw a nice tweet. Somebody cut that, did a screenshot, and it was by, I think, the Flat Earth Society posting on Facebook, all flat earthers around the globe will read this. Uh-huh. Which I found fantastic. Yeah. But it was the actual account that they used. So, but yeah. Anyway.
But what, yes, and, okay, and, but seriously though, what is this gesturing at? What is the pendulum? Why is it one of the central images of the book? What does it mean symbolically?
I mean, symbolically, it's really, as I said in the intro, it's a metaphor for a lot of things in the end. The center of the world and some kind of control. Then, as you pointed out, it's the mathematics that are pretty simple if you understand how to calculate a bit, which kind of prove where we are in case you want to know where we are. Then it also is a nice, like, a picture that is basically open for interpretation. I think it leaves a lot of room for stories to be written around it. Also, it has that circle that it kind of does while it is describing something else. So it does two things at the same time by being a very simple machine. And if we like take that picture and kind of bringing it in relation to the computer that they use, Abu Lafia or something, which is then again the word itself, some kind of Arabic old name. I don't really know anymore, but they use this computer, which is obviously a very basic old computer, but they feed it information so that they have an additional like memory first. And then they start telling the computer to mix the memory and bring it in a new order or to create stories on its own because they are working on their plan, which I find interesting. And then as they discovered the Gnostics, the Cabal, the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians and the Templars and all that stuff, they invent their own secret society on top of that because they felt it's missing. I forgot the name because it's missing something. So we need another, a more secret society. So like Peter Thiel and his dialogue recently, or not so recently. Anyway, I think the pendulum itself is a nice opening picture for the book. First of all, it does have you can actually add meaning to it based on your own interpretation again. But also it has a very basic function that kind of destroys a ton of other stuff that is nowadays at least getting prominence and is being talked about at anarchist conferences, which make them a hilarious, shitty event. Because if you go there and there's somebody on stage talking about the flat earth, nobody in the mainstream will take serious what you have to say else on that stage. So even if it makes sense. So. And then taking that computer picture that computer that they are using and their own secret society on top of that, it leads back to that simple point that you also explained very well, that he leaves open what you want to see, what you want to do with that. Because you can either be, I could have been depressed for 30 years and thought about the world, it's a black hole with all these crazy folks and conspiracies and fake money and whatever manufactured culture and the Laurel Canyon and everything is fake when you look at it. It kind of, I mean, the stuff that we are taught that is brought to attention in mass media, but it as the book leaves it open and also Echo doesn't tell you who he is really. You have to start on a journey. With that journey, I mean, that book literally made me buy at least 200 books. I mean, at least. I have an entire bookshelf where one box is just Umberto Eco, and the next two, three boxes left and right are stacked to the very top with books that I bought because of Foucault's Pendulum, because he mentions something like Rennes Le Chateau, and at that time there was no internet, so I was in that bloody bookstore every day or every second day, and I asked my grandparents and my relatives for money because we didn't have money, and I wanted to have a telescope to prove what the pendulum is doing and whatnot. And so the book, that's why I said it could be a nice door opener, because it gives you a task, it gives you a challenge, first with the language, then with the content, then with all these nuggets, but it does never at no point in the book tell you something is good or something is bad. There is no judgment. I mean, you might remember a page or so. I don't, but I don't, because as I said in the conversation before we started recording, I thought about rereading the book for the conversation, which I hesitated to do and didn't do because I read it 31 years ago and then I guess 21 or 20 years ago again. And I just wanted to have that old perspective. And I remember that he never told me what to think in comparison to the Dan Brown piece.
Right.
He's telling.
Right, exactly.
He's and telling that's, Hollywood that's how it is.
Yeah, that's exactly my problem with something like, you know, obviously Dan Brown is just, yeah. If Foucault's Pendulum is the thinking man's Da Vinci Code, the Da Vinci Code is the absolute, what's the politically correct word? Well, I don't know, the retard's version of Foucault's Pendulum, essentially. And it's just intelligence insulting because it tells you what to think at every point, whereas Foucault's Pendulum doesn't do that. But Foucault's Pendulum is told from the viewpoint of Kasabin. He is obviously the narrator whose head we are in or whose perspective we are seeing things from. And from that perspective, the question is, what do we think of Kasabin himself? And I have to admit, at the point at which Leah presents the very prosaic laundry list interpretation of the esoteric text, and what does that do? That basically prompts Kasabin to leave her and his newly born son, which is actually a pretty amazing, like, crazy part of the narrative if you think about it, but it is sort of just tucked in at the end of a chapter and not really explicitly referenced too much, so that if you're just reading along, you might kind of glance over that, but it's like, oh no, he just kind of left his family to go continue, you know, chasing this plot, which kind of raises the question. I mean, first of all, is Kasabin a likable character? But secondly, is he reliable at all? I mean, there, I think the text would even leave open the question of, did the whole craziness in the museum at night, did that even take place at all? Or is he actually going insane? Like, I guess there's some level of question about that even.
But also, maybe to add even or interject in regards to the pendulum, it also leaves him enough time, because the book starts off with Casaubon hiding in the museum next or close to that pendulum. And obviously, if you start the process, that pendulum takes quite a long time to actually do something. Mm-hmm. I mean, it runs for hours or days, depending on the size of the device. So it, since the book is a reprise, he thinks about his life. So while he's sitting there and then all this stuff happens, he explains all that. And the book ends right next, again, at that scene in the museum next to the pendulum, where then the secret society actually convenes that you thought is fiction because they are just putting things together on a computer. But then they actually meet there, and there are these like holographic whatever things.
But do they meet? Yeah, what is he seeing? What really happens there? Because it does, I was listening to one review that actually made a good point, that certainly at the point of the magic Afro Brazilian ritual thing that he attends in Brazil, there is sort of a narrative shift, and it's obviously, I'm reading through English translation, you're reading through German translation, so who knows what it actually comes across in Italian, but there is some sort of shift in style or tone at that point to almost some sort of magical realism sort of style, whereas the rest of the text seems to be presented very realistically. There are these moments of these crazy rituals and things that sort of, is this really happening? And what is really happening? And whose perspective are we seeing this from? But, you know, you raise another interesting part about the pendulum. Of course, pendulums in and of themselves are something about not only motion, but the periodicity of motion, about time and the passage of time and the movement of the stars and everything else, right? That's what's suggested in the pendulum. Whereas that is contrasted with that other image from which this book is constructed, the boy playing the trumpet in the cemetery, and the way that he tells that story that obviously becomes the missing piece of the Belbo puzzle that kind of puts everything together for the Belbo character. In that moment, Belbo playing, holding that note, even to the point where it becomes imperceptible and no one can even hear it, but he knows he's still holding that note. And he imagines the string of the trumpet connected to the sun, holding the entire universe in place. Everything is ordered. Everything, he calls it Zeno's arrow shooting out to the sun. It is stopping all motion. Everything is hanging on Belbo in that trumpet, and it is stopped. And of course, eventually it comes back with the pendulum and Belbo's ultimate fate, etc. So there is something about that contrast of trying to, I guess, stop the motion of the stars, stop the universe, stop everything, control it all, which is obviously part of what this plan is about. Because I'm not going to find it right off the top, but there was one of the epigraphs was from something to the extent of, essentially, once you get rid of God, once you need something to replace God with. And that is essentially what I think Belbo and others might be involved in their life course. They are looking for that moment of total connection with the universe that has been lost, and he's been trying to find it, and it's sort of symbolized in the pendulum, but he actually had it. It wasn't a symbol, as he says, at one point specifically. It wasn't a symbol. It didn't represent anything else. That moment with the trumpet was his actual connection with the universe. It was the point at which everything was ordered, and he's been seeking that out again. And I think that's sort of the quest of the plan, and why it so motivates everyone involved in this plan, including the people, the trace, which they invent and that then come together to basically propagate into existence this idea that has been invented. That is what is motivating everyone. This attempt to try to completely order the universe and essentially stop the motion of the stars, stop the pendulum from swinging, stop everything from moving so that they can control the universe. There's something about that I think is the core of the theme of the book.
That's true. And if I think about that in retrospective, I mean, I come from an area in southern Germany where again, Bavaria is like 2 hours or so by car, where the Illuminati were actually founded. Then it's close to Frankfurt, where the Rothschild steel and everybody comes from, and Rockefelle, where the Rockefellers originated. So it's kind of the center of what I'm researching today at some point, or to some extent. But the book actually leads to a point where and I didn't know the Illuminati book before, so I didn't know that was about a real plan. So it was fiction to me. But then I realized, okay, these Bavarian guys, that's why I went to the bookstore, if they had this crazy plan, maybe everything else in that book does some, I mean, there's some extent to it, of truth to it. And then, obviously, after reading that Illuminati book, I found out that there is nothing I can, the first reaction was, there is nothing I can believe anymore. I felt helpless first, then I felt powerless, then I felt lost in a world where I was supposed to take a career or earn money or achieve something. But what is there to achieve? So, I mean, he started off by basically leaving the question open. Then I read that book from that Livid guy who changed, in the end, changed my life. But he also brought me to that point, I think, that a lot of people had after COVID, because they realized that a lot of the stuff that they believed is fake. And I realized that when I was 16, and I really struggled for a week, and I didn't go to school anymore because I thought that's making no sense at all, and I don't need to earn money. So my natural reaction at that time was, I'm becoming a terrorist and die early. That's fine. So I'm going to blow things up. But obviously then, because of the art of Echo, leaving questions open and not coming to a deterministic worldview at the very end where things are lost, but where there is this like trio of researchers and publishers, he outlined a very interesting role that you can have in that world while you are searching for the truth. And that's, I think, still what I'm doing today is I'm still curious. I'm curious since I read the book, and I'm going to be curious until the day I die. And that is, I think, the most valuable lesson from the book, is that it made me curious to an extent where I can't stop asking questions. I need to see if that is the truth, and if it's just a word. I want to know, who is that? Where did that guy come from? When was he born? Did he have connections? And once and when I have a surface understanding of something, then I'm kind of satisfied, and then I move on. And but that is really it also formed my, let's say, my profession later on, because I did work in corporate industries for 30 plus years because I never made money with my like rebellious music and stuff. So I had my label, but I never earned money. But that's what I did. And during nights, on the weekends, I always did music and research and put the research into the music lyrics, which was the reason why I didn't sell anything. In the end, it outlines a very interesting perspective of what you can be in that world without giving you an answer, which is, I think, very helpful in comparison to other books that we also see nowadays, where this is the answer, that's the way to do it, that's the preparation you need to take, give me $100 for that package of whatever, survival food, where there is very simple ways of resolution. And I don't think that there is any simple way of resolution, because the only resolution is in yourself. Either you are happy with what you are doing in that world, be it in a prison cell, or you are not. So it's not depending on the surrounding. And the surrounding in that book is more than fluid. There is, it's volatile. There is nothing that you can hold on to in that book that is a reality. There is no reality, basically. It's only the people that have some kind of character and reality. But even that, as you pointed out, might be uncertain. So it's a great navigator or a help to navigate a world where there is no reality, I think.
I wonder if Echo would be happy with that story or would be crying at that story. And the fact that I don't know might actually be part of the delight of it. But yes, because in a sense, it's exactly what he has written about. He is the Kasabin who has written this intricate tale that has inspired this person and motivated him throughout his life and brought him on this big quest. But for what? And in what way? Is that a good thing? Is that what he intended? Or did he intend disbelief? Again, I'm not exactly certain. But of course, it raises the question, the fundamental question that's obviously here, postmodernism and the postmodern perspective, which is also, in a sense, alluded to with Foucault's pendulum, not Jean-Bernard Léon Foucault, Michel Foucault, right? Who Echo was obviously familiar with, and the question of postmodernism itself, which obviously is the context in which Echo is writing. I would say Echo is not straightforwardly a postmodernist. In fact, he, as I say, with that lecture that I was referencing on the ashes of postmodernism, a new realism, he did advocate for that there were limits to interpretation of a text, etc. So he was not a postmodernist in that sense. But there is sort of that postmodern perspective of, yes, it's all just, you can connect the dots any way you want, and everything is valid, and we're all just in this mess. So you might as well have fun with it, because what's the alternative? Yeah, living in depression and sorrow your whole life, or you can just have fun and delight in the fact, hey, I can connect these dots any way I want. And that has always, to me, represented that sort of, at least the playful side of the postmodern spirit of, hey, you might as well have fun with this. Whereas the modernist literary perspective was always this dour T.S. Eliot, the wasteland, and these poor men, with no souls wandering the earth because we've lost all meaning. No, it's like, hey, we've lost all meaning. We can do anything. So I guess it to some extent, there is sort of that question of what perspective do you take on this mess?
Yeah.
All right.
Go ahead. Echo considers it, Echo himself considers it its most mature piece of work, that book, in comparison to the other stuff he wrote. And there's even heavier books. But maybe I missed the punchline. I just wanted to add to that. I missed the punchline, I think. It's not that I'm kind of thrown off by that not having anything on to hold on to, or there's no reality, because in the end, it led me to one point where I figured out that the only thing that needs to be real in that world is myself. I have to be real. And I have to be real about what I want, what I don't want, and I'm going to always tell the truth. Yeah. And no matter the consequences. And that's exactly what I did. That's why school was a horror. That's why working was mostly difficult, because I never said anything else besides what I thought in that very moment without hesitation. And that is the only thing that you can be in that world, because there is real things. There are real things like family, there's love, there is real stuff around you that it's worth living for and dying for. And that is something I learned along the journey in a world where everything else is kind of volatile, fake, and not real. And maybe last sentence, Echo also impressed me with his knowledge. I wanted to be... I had a vision of myself when I'm 65 or 70. I want to be at least as well-read as that guy. Yeah. I want to know as much. I want to understand as much. And that's why now I recently learned the Italian in like 3 or 4 months. So I'm actually in a position where I can maybe next year or end of this year read his book in Italian language.
Yeah.
Or do a lecture around the corner here in sì, pronto, certo. And around the corner is the museum, Hermann Hesse Museum, which was the guy that made me go to the bookstore and buy Umberto Eco's book. So I'm going to maybe have a lecture there in Italian at some point next year, because I know that the museums guy and I sit in the cafe next to my house every now and then. So
beautiful.
Yes, exactly. That's why I felt it's the perfect book to talk about, because it's now at that point in life, I'm exactly where I, not really at the end of the journey, but I'm kind of where I wanted to be when I first went through the book and the first few weeks of horror and realization, but came to a conclusion that I have to be real, and that I have to kind of go along and then develop myself to a point where I can stand on top of things like Echo does, without judging, without telling people that's what it is. I'm the preacher. I know I have the truth. That's exactly what I'm not doing. I'm raising questions, and I hope that I can motivate other people to be happy, have a fulfilled life, and ask questions. That's pretty much all I want.
You know, I don't know what Echo would think of that, but I think that is admirable. I think I wonder what type of person I would have been, or how my life would have been different if I had read this book 31 years ago. But anyway, I'm reading it now, and it certainly puts a lot of things into perspective retroactively for me. Four observations that occur to me from our talk today. One, I'm just thinking about it. So as you say, the computer system that they're using here is a Bulafia. And Belbo gets the information, or gets the readout, or is using Abulafia, and Kasabin is taking that information, and Diotalevi is the sort of the end product of all of this, who ultimately gets cancer from it. A, B, C, D, Abulafia, Belbo, Kasabin, Diotalevi. I don't know. Maybe there's something in there. Secondly, as I opened today by observing, yes, the Francis Bacon New Atlantis connection was an interesting one, especially considering last month's edition of Film Literature and New World Order. And so I thought it was particularly funny, as Bacon became sort of a more and more important part of the plan and was, you know, connecting all these dots, until there is that scene that I will have to reread, because I was not quite sorting out who was who, but there is one of Belbo's computer files in which there is this elaborate scene in which Bacon is essentially imprisoning someone who is, of course, writing the plays that are then attributed to Shakespeare, but also writing things that are attributed to Bacon. So I thought that was particularly funny, because the people who are like, Bacon actually wrote Shakespeare, and Bacon wrote this, and Bacon was this genius. No, Bacon was just imprisoning someone else who was writing it all for him so that he could pass it off as his own. You simpletons. Thirdly, I will say, yes, you cannot read a text like this and not be genuinely impressed with the research that obviously went into this. And it truly leaves me with the impression that Umberto Eco, regardless of what he thinks or believes, or whether he believes any of this, could absolutely run circles around 99% of the conspiracy blowhards out there who try to work in this space and may know a thing or two about the Templars, or about the Rosicrucians, or about this, or about that. But Eco has probably read 300 times the number of books you have on absolutely every one of these subjects, and it's genuinely impressive. And fourthly, my fourth observation, I am going to start inserting, yes, but let us not forget, Minnie Mouse is Mickey's fiance, into any conversation I have in conspiracy realist circles that tends to get a little bit too self-serious. I will always throw that observation in from now on. But that's my wrap up to this conversation. Tom, do you have any final thoughts on this book before we start wrapping up here?
No, but I highly appreciate that I was finally, after that long time, able to talk to someone who has read the book, which was an amazing experience, because I never had the chance to do that.
Internet high and, five, yay.
Yes. And maybe one learning is really that, and I'm saying that in German every now and then, but in these times that we're living in, the real revolution is leading a happy life. That's the real revolution. However you manage that, whatever you do with it, but if you are happy and motivated and produce things, human things, that is what leads to a fulfilled life. The sense of life is giving life a sense. And that's the only thing, that's something that only you can do. And books help a lot. So switch off the TV, your computer, buy books, read books. That's what
write books.
Strengthens the inner force.
Yeah. Awesome. Amen to all that. Absolutely. I think that's, anyway, that's my philosophy. And you certainly have applied that philosophy. So let's talk a little bit about what you are doing and producing, because you're doing all sorts of things all the time. I understand you just got back from a tour. Maybe you're going on another tour, I don't know, and you're doing lectures and you're doing musical performances and you're running a publishing press. Like, tell us what's going on in Tom Oliver Rigenauer world.
Yes, I finished a tour in May. It was like 4 weeks live events. I mean, I do a presentation of 2 hours. So there's 1 hour in the break and then another presentation of another hour. And then I talk to the audience and answer questions about all the nice things that I just presented, because it's kind of having the same effect like that Illuminati book had on me sometimes. And then the next tour is actually starting September 3rd. So there's another month of traveling and trying to be with people in different cities throughout Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Because I think that's more important than internet conversations. And other than that, yeah, I'm publishing books as I did with yours. But other than that, there was this yellow one in the background, which is Organize Yourself. There was Stefan Hessel, who had released 2 books. He was a UN kind of some role, I don't know, for human rights. And then he had a book of with a similar title, and we just released it and explained what voluntarism is, because if you can't think of it and if you don't understand it, it's not going to manifest. And then I'm promoting my own anthology, which is the other book with the 4 apes, and the last one's Shooting His Head, which is the Age of AI ape. Luckily I'm now doing really what I want, because I've stopped working in the corporate world. So I'm writing, publishing books, touring, and I'm also working on a music project right now that's a solidarity project for the sanctioned EU journalists and Gaza. And my song is called Euthanasia. I think it's in English, because I want to help the EU die if I can.
An admirable goal. All right. As I mentioned at the top, obviously Rigenauer.press is where people can see about the Rigenauer Press. But is there any other links or anything you'd like to say, and any goodbye you'd like to say to the audience?
Nope. The central hub for my work is the homepage that you mentioned. There is nothing else to mention, because all the links are on there. There's the Internet Archive, where you can read and access all my texts and all my books for free, 2 of them even in English, on the Internet Archive. So download it if you feel like doing so and need 1,000 pages of English articles and research with a lot of sources. And other than that, switch off and do something outside.
All right, there he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's Tom Oliver Rigenauer. Of course, all the links to all of the things that we talked about today, and of course to Rigenauer Press, will be in the show notes for today's edition of Film Literature and the New World Order. But as usual, we have some of the Corbett Report members live in the audience watching along, and they have their comments and questions about the book as well. So let's start answering and discussing some of them. And we're going to start out with what I thought was an impressive feat from Priscilla, who writes, this book really pulled me in. I read it in a week and a half, which is a record for me. I haven't burned through a book that fast since college. And even just sort of a regular book, sure, that's impressive. But Foucault's Pendulum in a week and a half is truly an accomplishment. So absolutely, I guess this really did pull you in. It took me about a month to read through this one. So hats off to you, Priscilla. And I guess it really did pull you in order to do that. Other people talking about it's a high bandwidth book, so they didn't have the bandwidth for it. Understandable. We have Teresa in Europe. So she says, hi, James. I unfortunately have not visited the pendulum itself, and regret not to have gone when I lived there. The actual Foucault's pendulum has broken off in 2010 and had to be replaced. Some sources mention it was after a party. Public DJ parties were organized at night by the museum. Sounds like a bad idea. The original brass ball is located in another museum now. Also, one can't just walk underneath the Tour Eiffel at night anymore. There's a thick glass wall now shielding the visitors from any potential shootings. Europe in the 2020s. What a wonderful time to be alive. Priscilla also observes Bilbo really draws the line. Speaking of drawing lines, the emphasis on no made me think of Mark Passio. Interesting connection. Fine Skylark observes, don't conspiracy realists connect dots to avoid being taken advantage of and harmed by the powers that should not be? Connecting the dots, I think, is an act of self-preservation as well as protecting those around you. And certainly, I would say that's obviously one of the motivations, I would imagine, for a lot of people in the conspiracy realist space who don't like to be taken advantage of, don't like to be taken for suckers, don't like to be lied to, want to know about the world and how it really works. That seems obvious. But it does still raise the question, for example, in the novel itself, why Kasabin is so, in some sense, hurt by Leah's prosaic interpretation of that Templar or not Templar text, that he actually ends up leaving her. And I think we can all relate or have seen that take place. People who have their pet conspiracy theory that gets shot down or new evidence comes to light that puts it down, and they get genuinely hurt as if they invested something in that thing being true. It's not just some, I am just looking at observable reality and I have no opinion on it, and whatever is the facts reveal is whatever I will believe. I think people invest their identity in some theories, which itself I think is interesting and goes beyond simply that sort of self-preservation type of thing that is clearly part of the motivation. The Gecko observes, The book prompted us to go to the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris, where the pendulum now hangs. We asked where the periscope was. It's currently in the reserve. Apparently, Umberto was a friend of the then museum director who let him go through the back room for inspiration. So, yes, good to have friends in high places, isn't it? Let's see. Fine Skylark asks an interesting question. Do you think this book could be made into a film? Would they have to make three films? How long would it be? That's a very good question because, yeah, I'm making a singular film out of it. I mean, would it be like the Da Vinci Code film, right? I mean, that was a big hit starring Tom Hanks. No, it would not be like that. How would you film a book like this? Here's something that I read, and I guess I only read it in one spot, so I don't know if this is confirmed, but I can't remember which source I read it from, but it seemed very legit that apparently Stanley Kubrick had contacted Umberto Eco for the rights to this book. He was planning to make a movie out of Foucault's Pendulum, which, yeah, seems about right. I think if anyone was going to attempt it, someone like Kubrick, sure. But apparently Umberto Eco was so disappointed in how the Name of the Rose film turned out that he washed his hands of it. No, I'm not selling the rights. No. Don't do it. And I also read that later on, he came to regret that decision, as you do, thinking, you know, Stanley Kubrick was going to make a movie out of this. Maybe I should have given him the chance. Anyway, make of it what you will. What would a Kubrick Foucault's Pendulum have looked like? One can hardly imagine how you could condense that down into a singular movie. Teresa writes, regarding Abulafia, it just hit me how Eco got the idea of a computer generating texts on the basis of texts it has already. Isn't it basically how AI, the large language models, work today? And from what I understand today, Eco started researching for his book at least 46 years ago. Did he? I don't know. It got me thinking of Rur, a book by Carol Sapek, I'm sure I am pronouncing that wrong, please correct me, from 1920, where the future world is ruled by biorobots. It's just interesting these things appear ahead of their time. It is interesting, although I suppose for people whose realm is the realm of imagination and thinking about these things, it probably shouldn't be surprising that especially a semiotician like Eco, who thought about signs and symbols and how signifiers work and at some level how language itself works, would have been able to foresee that, yes, some sort of machine intelligence, or at least aping of language, would become an important part of this computer revolution that took place, which reminds me of another interesting anecdote I read about. Apparently, the entire sojourn of Kasabin in Brazil was kind of a diversion that Foucault was forced to write into the book because he wanted Kasabin to have participated in the 1968 student uprising. And then he had wanted Abulafia and the computer in the 1980s. And so there was this big narrative gap. It's like, well, what's happening in that time? Okay, Kasabin goes to Brazil. And that all became this whole section of the narrative that had to be written in order to connect those two dots. And it ends up being an incredibly important part of the story. So there you go. This is how these things happen. The Gecko observes, my husband got to the bit where the demonics are going on around the pendulum, and this morning he said he needed to go to mass to clear his head. Yeah. Sounds about right, yes. Priscilla writes, one of the things I enjoyed about this book was that it really displayed how you can find a rabbit hole to go down in pretty much any topic and link them together in all sorts of webs. That truly is one of the impressive things about this book that's difficult to articulate to the people who haven't read this book. But yes, the sheer amount of bizarre and seemingly tangential points about some whatever 13th century Benedictine monk who connects to this other thing over here, that, and it does have a plausibility about it. Once you start to see the plan that they're connecting and how one group of this plan is meeting with another every 120 years and how, and oh, that they missed that meeting because of the Gregorian, you know, calendar changeover and all of these things that makes absolute sense in a way that if this was the actual real documented history, you could go, yeah, okay, I see how that works anyway. So anyway, it is just, if nothing else, an impressive scholarly feat to have sorted out all this information and connected it in a plausible way across centuries of time. CD writes, all this philosophizing strikes me as very stoic in a strange way. Is that only me? I'll have to think about that. I suppose there is some stoicism to be had here, but I would again recommend people actually check out Echo, some of his nonfiction and or his lectures, etc., to get a better sense of where he's coming from philosophically. And let's go, one final comment. Fine Skylark observes that I would have chosen Fellini to direct the movie if he were still alive. Okay, interesting. Well, I think I've only seen one Fellini movie, but it was quite engaging and interesting. So yes, I think Fellini might have done something interesting with this book as well. And a fellow countryman might have made sense. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, as always, to all of the Corbett Report members playing along at home. And as a reminder, if you want to join this live stream discussion of the book and have your comments featured here and questions answered on air, that is available for Corbett Report members. And of course, the information will always be in the Corbett Report subscriber newsletter the week before this conversation takes place. But maybe that's not the best way to do this. Cindy Sunshine has an idea. I think it would be good to have the Corbett Report Book Club be at corbettreport.com/books, because it's an easy URL to remember. This page would remind us which book Corbett is reading this month. At the top of the page could be a link to the time zones for the next book club meeting date time, links to any online places where the book could be read, a link to the bottom half of your reportage page for ideas on where the book might be bought, a video clip introducing a video clip introducing the book, a link for subscribers who want to attend the meeting. After that, it would be great to have a link to corbettreport.com/category/FLNWO, which has past FLNWO book club videos. Thank you for the suggestion, Cindy, and I will take it into consideration. I kind of like the exclusivity of this endeavor and the fact that if you want to join this live stream book club production, you have to kind of work for it. You have to actually care enough to try. I kind of like that because it's maybe like Echo writing the 100 pages of penitence into the beginning of Name of the Rose. You have to actually work for it and show that you actually want to be here. I think that's probably the best way to have fruitful conversations. But I'll leave it up to the Corbett Report members in the crowd. If I hear from, say, 10 Corbett Report subscribers who said, I'd love to participate in the live stream, but I just can't figure out where it is or when it's happening, I absolutely 100% would be there if there was a corbettreport.com/books, like Cindy describes there. If I hear from 10 people who second that idea, I will make it happen. Anyway, in the meantime, you might be interested in what is next month's book club book to be read, and I will reveal that here. It is called The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. It is by Philip K. Dick, who presumably some of you will already know as an author. Maybe you've read this book, maybe not, but if not, here's your chance. It's not a particularly voluminous book and should be fairly easy to read in a month. And if Priscilla can read Foucault's Pendulum in a week and a half, then I think we can all read Philip K. Dick in a month. So look forward to that. As usual, the links to that book and all of the things we've talked about today will be at CorbettReport.com, where you will be able to find this podcast. So thank you very much all for your participation in this enterprise. Man, what an undertaking it was to read this book, but absolutely worth it. And as I said to Tom, I cannot believe no one has recommended this book to me at all, ever in my life until now. But I'm glad that he did that. So everyone give a big round of applause to Tom Oliver Reganauer for bringing this book to our attention. And that's going to do it for this month's edition of Film Literature and the New World Order. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Looking forward to talking to you all out there again in the not too distant future.